some of them will not be allowed to return. This has happened in 1967 and 1948. And the document, which, by the way, you can read in full on the Plus 972 magazine website or the Local Call website, actually deals with this. It says, it reads in the documents that Egypt will have an obligation under humanitarian law to allow for Palestinian civilians to flee and enter and find refuge in its territory. And it calls on enlisting the United States and other Western countries to pressure Egypt to do this. Now, you know, everything, we're in a situation of extreme fog, and it's unclear how this will develop. But the fears are completely justifiable.
Yuval, I want to thank you for bearing through this rainfall in Jerusalem. But I wanted to go to another piece. I wanted to go to another piece that you've written, saying the headline, "Settlers Take Advantage of Gaza War to Launch West Bank Pogroms." While the U.S. government, before Hamas's surprise October 7th attack that killed up to 1,400 Israelis, the U.S. government, Jake Sullivan, the national security adviser, something like 10 days before, said the Middle East is quiet now and we can move on to other issues. But in fact, in the West Bank, it was the deadliest year in years, right? You had more than a Palestinian a day being killed, either by the Israeli military or Jewish settlers. And now, since October 7th, Israeli settler attacks have resulted in at least 115 Palestinian deaths, more than 2,000 injured, nearly 1,000 others forced to flee their homes. Can you talk about what it's like to be in the West Bank, this increased Jewish settler violence, and also you have a friend who was the target of the violence?
Yes, yes, Amy, of course. I mean, I've just received a text message. 123 Palestinians have been already killed in the West Bank since the beginning of the war, and seven of them have been actually murdered by Israeli settlers. And I spend a lot of my time in the West Bank, specifically in a region called Masaf Riyata, which is a region in the southern edge of the West Bank, a community of villages that for decades have faced really intense pressure and violence from the Israeli army that constantly destroys their homes and refuses to give them permits, and from settlers that have been attacking them. And I think what is happening now is that settlers and soldiers are using this chaos of the war to continue and to end sort of this forced transfer. And it was extremely horrifying to be there over the past few nights. We've had incidents where settlers entered one village, it's called Susia, they grabbed the boy and his father, and they told them, you have 24 hours to leave the village or we're going to murder everybody in the village. We had an incident where one settler went down to the village and actually shot a Palestinian who was standing next to the mosque. There are incidents of torture, of abuse, of humiliation, and it's happening every night. Like, I stayed up last night with a family. They're not sleeping, and everybody is just, like, we see the settlers entering the village. And I think that, you know, according to human rights organization, Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem, 13 Palestinian communities have already been displaced in the West Bank due to this settler violence. And it will just increase and increase as long as the war continues, the bombing on Gaza continues, and this situation continues.
You know, the national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, this is a man who, what, in the last 15 years, was convicted in Israeli court of being supporting a terrorist organization and inciting violence against Palestinians. He announced the purchasing of 10,000 rifles for Israelis in West Bank settlements. Can you talk about what that means? Has that been carried out? And what supporting settler violence, what that means, particularly now?
Yeah, of course. So what is going on right now is a complete inability to even differentiate between who is a soldier and who is a settler. Is it a settler that is in reserves? Is it a settler that received a weapon from Ben-Gvir and put on, you know, his army uniform? Are these soldiers? There is a complete confusion, and we are seeing a lot of quote-unquote independent settler initiatives where they are putting on soldier uniforms and going into villages and harassing Palestinians. This is happening all over Area C. This is the way the military refers to it, which is essentially all of the open territories in the West Bank, where there are 180 small Palestinian villages and all the Israeli settlements. And Israel's policy for many years has been to try to forcibly evict these 180 communities. And I think now, with many more settlers receiving weapons, with all of these incidents of murder and threats, this eviction is taking place. And I think definitely the arming of so many people is part of that process, which is, you know, understood in Israeli society also as a response to October the 7th, the need of people to be armed, to be able to defend themselves. At least in the West Bank, these weapons are used to evict Palestinians from their homes.
And finally, how have Israeli activists and international charities been involved in supporting Palestinians in the West Bank?
So, I'm not sure about international charities. I mean, I know that a lot of them have supplied these communities that are at risk of forced transfer little homes that they can live in, because Israel always comes and destroys their homes. They can't get building permits. And it was extremely ironic. Like, I was in a village called Zanuta in this area of Masafer Yatta 2 days ago, and the residents were dismantling all of these homes using their own hands. And they were essentially leaving the village. I spoke to a 70-year-old person who told me that, you know, we drank tea, and he said, this is probably the last time I will drink tea in this place that I grew up in. So these international organizations, you know, all of this support is now just being dismantled by the residents who are afraid for their lives. I think what we as Israeli activists are trying to do there, and this is not always working, but the fact that we are Israeli, the fact that we speak Hebrew, gives us a certain privilege. And when these attacks happen, we try to de-escalate the situation. We try to make sure that the settlers that are attacking the village see us, that we are first, that we can film them, that there are journalists here. We try to talk in Hebrew. But things, you know, death is now everywhere, and things are deteriorating really, really quickly. And I feel like all of the things that we were previously doing are now not working. And you know, again, I have to ask the world to wake up, to call for a ceasefire. If we continue to destroy Gaza like this, it will destroy us as well. We will not have security in the future, and it will destroy the West Bank and the possibility of ever living here in equality and in peace between Israelis and Palestinians. So it's time to change course and talk about the political issues at hand.
Yuval Abraham, an Israeli journalist based in Jerusalem, who reports for Plus972 magazine and Local Call, will link to his article, Expel All Palestinians from Gaza, Recommends Israeli Government Ministry. When we come back, we speak to Josh Paul. He recently resigned from the State Department in protest of the Biden administration's policies on Israel and Palestine. Back in 30 seconds.
Oh, they've killed all the little ones while their faces still smile. With their guns and their fury, they erased their young lives. No longer to laugh, no longer to be a child. Oh, they've killed all the little ones while their faces still smile. Now they're burying the little ones, and they're making the graves deep, so the world cannot see that tonight we may sleep.
While they the little ones, a new song released this week by Yusuf Islam, also known as Cat Stevens. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Amidst growing international condemnation of Israel's month-long assault on Gaza, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is back in Israel today to meet with Israeli officials, where he continued to emphasize Israel's right to defend itself following the October 7th Hamas attack. Meanwhile, the White House continues to dismiss calls for a full ceasefire, saying instead any pauses in fighting should be temporary and localized. This comes as the independent news outlet in these times reports the White House has requested an unprecedented loophole in arms spending to allow it to, quote, be able to conduct arms deals with Israel in complete secrecy without oversight from Congress or the public, unquote. Even as experts say, Israel's been using U.S.-supplied weapons to commit war crimes, unquote. Meanwhile, a new HuffPost report cites five current and one recently deported State Department official who say their, quote, expertise and standard decision-making processes are being treated as largely irrelevant to President Joe Biden's strategy on the war, which prioritizes support for Israel, unquote. One official described, quote, particular concern about the town hall for the department's branch on human rights. Managers who described the branch as state's conscience indicated they aren't sure if they're getting through to more senior officials. For more, we're joined by Josh Paul, the State Department official who resigned last month in protest of Biden's push to increase arms sales to Israel amidst its siege on Gaza, calling it short-sighted, destructive, and contradictory. In his resignation letter that went viral, Josh Paul wrote, quote, "We cannot be both against occupation and for it. We cannot be both for freedom and against it. And we cannot be for a better world while contributing to one that is materially worse. I believe to the core of my soul that the response Israel is taking, and with it the American support both for that response and for the status quo of the occupation, will only lead to more and deeper suffering for both the Israeli and the Palestinian people, and is not in the long-term interest. And it is not in the long-term American interest," unquote. Josh Paul is former director of congressional and public affairs for the Bureau of Political Military Affairs in the State Department, which oversees arms transfers to Israel and other foreign nations. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Josh Paul.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm glad to join you.
Can you elaborate on why you decided to resign? You're a veteran State Department official. Why you said no?
Yes, thank you. I decided to resign for three reasons, the first and most pressing of which is the very, I believe, uncontroversial fact that U.S.-provided arms should not be used to massacre civilians, should not be used to result in massive civilian casualties. And that is what we are seeing in Gaza, and what we were seeing, you know, very soon after the October 7th horrific attack by Hamas. I do not believe arms should be U.S.-provided arms should be used to kill civilians. It is that simple. Secondly, I also believe that, you know, as your previous guest identified, there is no military solution here, and we are providing arms to Israel on a path that has not led to peace, has not led to security, neither for Palestinians nor for Israelis. It is a moribund process and a dead-end policy. And yet, when I tried to raise both of these concerns with State Department leadership, there was no appetite for discussion, no opportunity to, you know, look at any of the potential arms sales and raise concerns about them, simply a directive to move forward as quickly as possible. And so I felt I had to resign.
So talk more about that. Talk more about what kind of dialogue goes on at the State Department. And if you, for example, have met with Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, not to mention President Biden, to voice your concerns. And what about other veteran State Department officials?
So typically there is a very robust policy process in the State Department for arms transfers, and there are a lot of those, right? So we're talking about 20,000 arms sale cases a year that the State Department processes, which could be anything from bullets to radios to fighter jets. And for each of those, there is a lengthy process sometimes that looks at, you know, what are the pros and cons of the sale? What are its human rights implications? That has not happened in this context for Israel. And as I say, when I raised those concerns against the existing laws, against the existing policies, there was no appetite for that discussion. I have not personally spoken to Secretary Blinken about this, nor certainly to President Biden. But I know that in the time since I left, there has been increasing discussion within the State Department, but has not led to any change of policies. In fact, as you heard earlier on your show, Vice President Harris was just saying yesterday that we will not place any conditions whatsoever on our arms to Israel. And that is unlike any arms transfer decision I've ever been a part of. There's always discussion about should we condition this to address human rights issues.
So who's leading this, Josh Paul? Who is preventing this? Who is suppressing all of this discussion within the State Department?
I honestly think in some ways it is coming from the very top of the U.S. government and from the Biden White House. You know, there are many in the State Department and across government who have reached out to me in recent weeks since I left to express their support, but also to say how difficult and how horrific they are finding U.S. policy, and yet are being told when they try to raise these concerns, look, you can get emotional support. If you're finding this difficult, we'll find you something else to work on. But don't question the policy because it's coming from the top.
The HuffPost has this new piece that reports a task force on preventing atrocities did not meet until 2 weeks into the war, and officials say department leaders are telling them their expertise won't affect policy. Explain what goes on.
So whenever there is a crisis, as there is right now in Israel and Gaza, the department sets up a task force or multiple task forces that are uniquely shaped to address that crisis. So, for example, in the context of an earthquake, they might bring in experts on, you know, refugee issues, on weather issues, on disease issues, you know, that sort of, you know, broad swath of people. In the context of Gaza, they have set up a task force to look at this problem. But according to the report you cite, it does not include the Bureau of Population, Refugees and Migration, who are responsible for, you know, U.S. support to refugee issues. So it is either a stunning oversight or it is an intentional disregard for the humanity of Palestinian civilians in Gaza.
At a meeting on October 26, a State Department source told you they recalled a top official advising staff to shift their focus away from Israel-Palestine and seek to make a difference in other parts of the world.
So I don't believe that that was a conversation that I had with someone, but that is in the same report in the Huffington Post that you cite. Yes.
So they're directing them not even to make comments on this, just stop talking about Israel-Palestine.
Yes, that's right. And I think, look, I mean, that reflects a tension or a censorship, right, that we are seeing not only in the U.S. government. I think what's interesting here is that there is this censorship that has existed and expanded, you know, to colleges and universities, where you talked about the doxing. I've also heard from many people across the American private sector, both from the Arab American community, but also more broadly from all sorts of diverse communities, who've said, we are afraid to speak up on this because we are in fear of our jobs. It's the same climate in government, and that is just not American.
So I wanted to ask you about this In These Times report that the White House has requested an unprecedented loophole in arms spending to allow it to be able to conduct arms deals with Israel in complete secrecy without oversight from Congress or the public.
Yes. So we provide Israel with $3.3 billion a year in foreign military financing, which is the State Department and U.S. government's primary function or primary mechanism for funding the sale of arms to other countries. Of note, you know, we typically provide, setting aside Ukraine, about $6 billion a year in foreign military financing around the world. So Israel already gets more than half of that. The language in the supplemental request that the Biden administration sent up, would remove the requirement to notify Congress of any arms sales conducted under that funding. Typically, there is a process where for any major defense sale, Congress is notified of it. And there's actually a process prior to the formal notification where Congress gets to ask questions, poke, prod, delay. And then if it wishes to oppose a sale, can raise a joint resolution of disapproval on the floor. What this proposal would do is essentially destroy all of that, remove all of that, remove that congressional oversight, remove that congressional ability to object. It is unprecedented. I've never seen anything like it. And I cannot imagine that the committees of jurisdiction are viewing it very favorably, because it is just, you know, such a damaging approach that also sets horrible precedent for other countries with whom, you know, future administrations may decide they don't want Congress to be involved.
Since you are in charge of arms sales, what does this $14 billion that, well, it looks like both houses want to send it to Israel. It's just that the House one is controversial because they want to take that $14 billion from the IRS. And also they want to sever the funding for Israel from the funding for Ukraine. And Chuck Schumer, the Senate majority leader, says he won't consider this bill. But it sounds like there is enough support in both houses for that extra, not the 3.8 or 3.3 billion yearly aid to Israel, but an extra $14 billion. You're the expert on arms sales. What would it be used for?
Yeah, and let me just say, I think there is, you know, almost or near unanimous congressional support for this further military assistance to Israel. And I think what's fascinating about that is also there's a massive disconnect between where Congress is on these issues and where, I think, if you look at the polling, the American public are. And I think the current crisis is really crystallizing that difference. I don't think it will make any difference in terms of the passage of this package, but it may do down the line. With regards to this package specifically, it includes $3.5 billion in foreign military financing. Israel can draw on that to purchase essentially what it wants. And what's unusual about this as well, in addition to the removal of the notification, is that Israel would be entitled, under the proposed sent to Congress, to spend all of this money within its own defense industry. Israel is, of course, a top 10 exporter of arms around the world, often competing with the United States. And the idea that we will be providing funding to subsidize that competition is really unimaginable. But on top of that, the package also provides further funding from the Defense Department side for air and missile defense for Israel, for Iron Dome. And let me be clear, my concern here is on lethal assistance to Israel. When it comes to protecting civilians from rocket attacks, I believe that they should be. I don't believe anyone should have to live in fear of their homes, in their homes, from rockets raining down on them. Although I believe that's the case whether they are in Israel under Iron Dome, or whether they are in Gaza, for example. And, of course, we never ask that question. The funding, finally, would also include research and development funding for equipment such as there is a experimental laser project called Iron Beam, which the U.S. and Israel are working together on, air and missile defense system. If this is an emergency request, why are we looking at research and development for projects that have not even materialized yet? That doesn't sound like an emergency to me. So as with the arms transfers I saw when I was departing from the department, I think there is just a rush to push everything they can while they feel there is a window of political opportunity here where there will be no significant opposition.
What kind of response was there to your resignation?
To my resignation, I would say there has been an overwhelming response that I've heard from folks, from colleagues inside not only the State Department, but across the U.S. government, actually, on the Hill, in the Defense Department, in the uniformed military services, including in combatant commands around the world. People have reached out to me to say, you know, we fully agree with you. You know, obviously, everyone has their own personal circumstances. You know, I think if we had universal healthcare, it would make it a bit easier for people to stand up on principle. I myself am, you know, trying to figure out what I do next on healthcare. But the point is that so many people have reached out to say, we hear you, we agree with you. And I think, you know, one of the things I found is that a lot of people can be in individual offices and say, there is no, I can't speak up because I will lose my job. I will put my career in jeopardy. And there's no one else here I can talk to. And yet I'm hearing from someone else just a few desks over who is saying the same thing. So I think there really is a communications crisis, a transparency crisis within the U.S. government, and a policy crisis, because when you can't talk about foreign policy, when you can't debate, when you can't criticize, you don't end up with good policy.
Josh Paul, why was this the last straw for you? I mean, for example, if you were in charge of weapons sales, presumably you were dealing with Saudi Arabia, notoriously authoritarian. U.S. agencies concluded, even in just one case, the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, that the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, was responsible for this. You oversaw arms sales to them, presumably. Why Israel?
So let me just be clear. I was one of multiple people involved in the arms sales process. Arms sales themselves are a presidential authority that is delegated to the Secretary of State and then through the Secretary of State to the Undersecretary, who is actually responsible for approving them for the most part. But you're right. And as I said in my resignation letter, in my time in the department, I dealt with many, you know, morally challenging, controversial arms sales. I think what made the difference for me here is that for all of those previous instances, even under the Trump administration, mind you, there was always room for discussion and debate and the ability to mitigate some of the worst possible outcomes, to delay sales until, you know, crises had passed so that they weren't contributing immediately into a humanitarian crisis, to work with Congress and be confident that once the policy debate had ended in State Department, there would be a congressional piece to it, too. And Congress genuinely has stood up in the past repeatedly on matters of human rights and arms sales. What was different here was that there was none of that. There was no debate. There was no space for debate. And there was also no congressional appetite or willingness to have debate.
There's going to be a major march in Washington tomorrow. 350 people are arrested in Philly. We're going to play some clips of a major protest in Boston that happened last night. How much does grassroots protests like this, the thousands of people are protesting around the country, the shutdown of Grand Central by Jewish groups just last Friday night, have on the State Department, on the White House?
So I don't think it has much impact on the State Department. And that's okay, because I think policy processes are meant to happen within a policy framework. Again, the problem is they're not happening. I think it does have an impact on the White House. I think we've seen a significant change in tone in the last few weeks, not because there is a sudden deep care, frankly, for Palestinian civilian casualties on their own merits, but because there is a sense that there is a political crisis here developing for the Biden administration, that many people are saying, you know, we're just going to sit out the next election. We have lost faith in this White House, in this administration. So I think that does have an impact. And let me also say, I have found it incredibly moving as well to watch these protests. You know, I was up on the Hill for meetings, you know, this week and last week, and came across in one office a sit-in that was happening where there was a group of Jewish students singing peace songs and holding up signs that said, Save Gaza. I found that incredibly moving. And I think it also tells Congress and it tells this administration that they are not in line with much of American public opinion. I think it's a much-needed message.
Josh Paul, veteran State Department official who worked on arms deals and resigned last month in protest of a push to increase arms sales to Israel amidst the attack on Gaza. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We end today's show with voices from the streets of Boston, where hundreds of faith leaders and clergy rallied Thursday to demand Senators Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey support a ceasefire.
Is Elsa. I'm the daughter of Holocaust refugees, and I'm here because it's outrageous to me the Israeli government is committing genocide in the name of people like my parents. And I work with Jewish Voice for Peace. We demand a ceasefire now before even more innocent lives get lost.
I'm Jill. I'm active in Jewish Voice for Peace. I'm here to demand Senator Warren declare a ceasefire and to stand up for justice. She usually does stand up for justice in different kinds of ways. For some reason, she just can't seem to stand up for Palestinian lives. They are bombing everything, churches, hospitals, roads. There's no place to go. So we are demanding Warren to do the right thing.
My name is Rami. I am here today marching because I think we need to have a ceasefire. I think it's really important that the world see that Jewish community believes in a ceasefire and thinks that what Israel is doing right now is wrong, and that the Jewish community is not a monolith, and there isn't one uniform perspective standing with Israel on this one.
My name is Leora. I am a rabbi in Jamaica Plain. Anyone who's here today might be risking things to be here, relationships or employment. And I'm so proud to be here across many kinds of difference and united in our call for a ceasefire now. We mourn for all of the dead and we fight for all of the living.
Yeah!
And hospitals are not safe.
My name is Mohamed Musalam. I am a khatib here in Massachusetts, in Malden. If ceasefire is not now, when will it be? Are they waiting for the entire population of Gaza to be completely wiped out? Are they waiting for 10 more thousand, 20 more thousand people dying before they call for ceasefire? Enough is enough.
I do not come here alone. I carry my people in my bones.
So we're here at voices from protest in Boston last night calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. At least 23 people were arrested. This comes as 13 Democratic senators call for short-term cessation of hostilities in Gaza. And that does it for our show. Special thanks to Hani Massoud, Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Tammy Warrenoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.